You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 99, by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures, translated by Johanna Collis. This is Lecture 5, entitled Communal Life, Between Death and a New Birth, Into the Physical World, given in Munich on May 29, 1907. We have come to the point in our studies where we heard that the human being who is descending from spiritual regions is clothed in an ether body and has for a brief moment a pre-vision of the life that is awaiting him on earth. We saw the abnormalities and conditions to which this may give rise. Before proceeding, we will answer a question that may seem of importance to those who turn their spiritual eyes to Devakan. In what sense is there community of life among human beings between death and a new birth? There is indeed community of life not only among people on the physical earth, but also in the higher worlds. Just as the activities of human beings in the spirit realm reach down into the physical world, so do all the relationships and connections that are established between individuals on earth stretch up into the spiritual world. We will take a concrete example of this, namely the relationship between mother and child. Is there a relationship between them that endures? There is, indeed, and moreover, a much more intimate, much firmer relationship than can ever be established here on earth. At first, mother love is a kind of natural instinct. It has something of an animal character. As the child grows up, this relationship becomes a moral, ethical, spiritual one. When mother and child learn to think together, when they share experiences in common, natural instinct withdraws more and more into the background. It has merely provided the opportunity for the forging of that beautiful bond, which is present in the very highest sense in the mother's love for the child and the child's love for the mother. The mutual understanding and love that unfolds here continues on into the regions of the spiritual world, even though, as the result of one dying earlier, the other seems for a time to be separated from the dead. After this period has passed, the link that was on earth is equally vital and intimate. The two are together, only all the purely natural animal instincts must have been laid aside. The feelings and thoughts that weave between one soul and another on earth are not hindered in the spiritual world by the barriers that exist on earth. Devakan actually assumes a particular appearance and structure as a result of the relationships that are woven here on earth. Let us take another example. Friendships and affinities are born from the kinship of souls. They continue on into Devakan, and from them the social connections for the next life develop. By establishing connections with souls here, we are therefore working at the form which Devakan acquires. We have, all of us, worked in this way when bonds of love were forged between ourselves and others. Thereby we create something that has significance not only for the earth, but which also shapes conditions in Devakan. What happens here as the fruit of love, of friendship, of mutual understanding, all these things are building stones of temples in the spiritual region above. And those who have this certainty cannot but be inspired by the knowledge that when bonds are forged from soul to soul here on earth, this is the foundation of an eternal becoming. Let us suppose for a moment that on some other physical planet there were beings incapable of mutual sympathy, incapable of forming bonds of love amongst one another. Such beings would have a very barren Devakan. Only a planetary region where bonds of love are forged between one being and another can have a Devakan rich in content and variety. Although his presence cannot be experienced by ordinary humans, someone who is already in Devakan possesses greater or less consciousness of communion with those who have remained behind on the earth, depending on his stage of development. There are even means whereby these bonds of communion can be intensified. If we send thoughts of love, but not of egoistic love, to the dead, we strengthen the sense of community with them. It is a mistake to assume that the consciousness of the human being in Devakan is dim or shadowy. This is not the case. The degree of consciousness once attained by an individual can never be lost, although darkenings can occur during certain periods of transition. Human beings in Devakan have, through their spiritual organs, clear consciousness of what is happening in the sphere of the earth. Esotericism reveals that human beings in the spiritual world share an experience of what is taking place on the earth. So we see that life in Devakan, if viewed in its reality, loses every element of comfortlessness. We see that human beings, when they cease to regard it from their earthly egoistic standpoint, can experience it as a condition of infinite blessedness, quite apart from the fact that any freedom from the physical body, freedom from the lower nature in which they are enclosed here, brings with it a feeling of intense relief anyway. The fact that the barriers have fallen away, this in itself brings a feeling of rapture. Devakan is thus a time of expansion and expression in all directions. There is a richness and an absence of restriction that are never experienced on the earth. We have heard that on their descent to a new birth, human beings are clothed with a new ether body by means of a rank similar to that of the folk spirits. This ether body is not a perfect fit for the reincarnating individual, and still less perfectly fitted is the physical body he receives. We will now speak in broad outline of the incorporation of human beings into the physical world. Something more detailed would in some ways be unsuitable for public description. We have heard that in accordance with their qualities, human beings clothe themselves with an astral body. Through what is contained in this astral body, they are attracted to certain human beings here on the earth. And through the ether body, they are drawn to the nation, and to the family in the wider sense, into which they are to be born anew. According to the way in which they have developed their astral body, they are drawn to the mother. The essence, the substance, the organization of the astral body draws them to the mother. The ego draws them to the father. The ego was present even in ages of remote antiquity, when the soul descended for the first time from the depths of the Godhead into an earthly body. This ego has developed through many incarnations. The ego, the I, of one human being is distinct from the ego of another, and at the present stage of evolution gives rise to the force of attraction to the father. The ether body attracts human beings to the nation, to the family. The astral body attracts them particularly to the mother, and the I to the father. The whole descent to the new incarnation is guided in accordance with these principles. It may happen that the astral body is attracted to a mother, but that the ego is not attracted to the corresponding father. In such a case, the search continues until a suitable pair of parents is found. In the present phase of evolution, the I, or ego, represents the element of will, of impulses of sensitivity. In the astral body lie the capacities of fancy or imagination, the capacities of thinking. The latter qualities, therefore, are transmitted by the mother, the former by the father. The individuality was approaching incarnation, uses unconscious forces to seek out the parents who are to provide the physical body. In its essentials, all this takes place by about the third week after conception. From the moment of conception onward, the being consisting of I, astral, and ether bodies remains near the mother who carries the fertilized human ovum, working on it from the outside. Then, at about the third week, the astral and ether bodies take hold, you might say, of the ovum, and now begin to participate in the work on the embryo. Up to that moment, the development of the physical body proceeds without influence of the astral and ether bodies. But from then onward, these bodies participate in the development of the child and themselves influence the further development of the embryo. We thus see that what was said about the ether body holds good still more for the physical body, so that complete suitability is even less easy to obtain here. This significant fact sheds light upon a great deal that happens in the world. Up to this point, we have been speaking of the normal evolution of the average modern human being. What has been said does not altogether hold good of someone in whom spiritual development began in a previous incarnation. The higher the stage attained, then, the earlier does such an individual begin to work upon his own physical body in order to make it more suitable for the mission to be fulfilled on earth this time. The later the individual takes command of the physical ovum, the less control will he have over the physical body. The most highly developed individualities, those who are the guides and leaders of the spiritual life of the earth, take command even at the moment of conception. Nothing takes place without their collaboration. They direct their physical body right up to the time of their death, and begin to prepare a new body directly the first impetus for this is given. The substances of which the physical body is composed are perpetually changing. After about 7 years, every particle has been renewed. The substance is exchanged, but the form endures. Between birth and death, the substances of the physical body must continually be born anew. They are the ever-changing element. What we develop between birth and death, in such a way that death has no power over it, this is preserved and builds up a new organism. The initiate performs consciously, between death and a new birth, what the average human being performs unconsciously between birth and death. The initiate consciously builds up his new physical body. For him, therefore, birth amounts to no more than an outstanding event in his existence. He exchanges the substances only once, but then fundamentally. Hence there is considerable similarity of stature and form in such individualities from one incarnation to the next. Whereas in those who are but little developed, there is no similarity of form whatever in their successive incarnations. The higher the development of a human being, the greater is the similarity in two successive incarnations. This is clearly perceptible to clairvoyant sight. There is a specific expression to describe this higher stage of development. It is not said that such an individual is born in a different body any more than it is said of the average human being that he receives a new body every 7 years. Of a master, it is said, he is born in the same body. He uses it for hundreds, even thousands of years. This is the case with the vast majority of leading individualities. An exception is formed by certain masters who have their own special mission. With them, the physical body remains, so that death does not occur for them at all. These are the masters whose task it is to watch over and bring about the transition from one root race or epoch to another. Two other questions arise at this point, that of the duration of the sojourn in the spiritual worlds, and that of the individual's gender in consecutive incarnations. Esoteric investigation reveals that 1,000 to 1,300 years is the average span of life between incarnations. The reason for this is that the individual will find the face of the earth changed on his or her return, and therefore be able to have new experiences. Changes on the earth are closely connected with certain constellations of the stars. This is a very significant fact. At the beginning of spring, the sun rises in a certain zodiacal constellation. It began to rise in Aries 800 years before Christ. Before that epoch, it rose in the adjacent constellation of Taurus. About 2160 years are required for the passage through one constellation. The circuit through the whole 12 constellations is known in esotericism as a cosmic year. The peoples of antiquity were deeply sensible of what is connected with this passage through the zodiac. With feelings of awe and reverence, they said, "When the sun rises in spring, nature is renewed after its winter repose. Nature is awakened from deep sleep by the divine rays of the vernal sun. This young, fresh power of spring linked itself with the constellation from which the sun was shining." They said, "This constellation is the bestower of the sun with its new vigor. It is the bestower of the new divinely creative power." Thus the Lamb was regarded as the benefactor of humanity by those living 2,000 years ago. All sagas and legends concerning the Lamb originated during that age. Conceptions of the Godhead were associated with this symbol. During the early centuries of our era, the Redeemer himself, Christ Jesus, was depicted by the symbol of the cross, and beneath it, the Lamb. Not until the 6th century AD was the Redeemer portrayed on the cross. The sun rising in Aries is, similarly, also the origin of the well-known myth of Jason and the quest of the Golden Fleece. In the epoch preceding 800 BC, the sun was passing through the constellation of Taurus. In Egypt, we find the veneration of the Apis bull. In Persia, the veneration of the Mithras bull. Earlier still, the sun was passing through the constellation of Gemini. In Indian and Germanic mythologies, we find definite indications of twins. The twin he-goats, drawing the chariot of the god Donar, are a last remnant of this. Finally, we reach back to the epoch of Cancer, which brings us near to the time of the Atlantean flood. An ancient culture passed away and a new culture arose. This was designated by a particular esoteric sign, the vortex, which is the symbol of Cancer and is to be found in every calendar. Thus peoples have always had a clear consciousness of the fact that what proceeds in the heavens runs parallel with the changes taking place on the earth beneath. When the sun has completed its passage through one constellation, the face of the earth is changed to such an extent that it is profitable for the human being to enter a new life. For this reason, the time of reincarnation depends upon the precession of the vernal equinox. The period required by the sun for its passage through one zodiacal constellation is the period within which the human being is twice incarnated, once as a man and once as a woman. The experiences in a male and female organism are so fundamentally different for spiritual life that the human being incarnates once as a woman and once as a man into the same conditions of the earth. This makes an average of 1,000 to 1,300 years between two incarnations. Here we have the answer to the question concerning gender. As a rule, gender alternates. This rule, however, is often broken, so that sometimes there are 3 to 5, but never more than 7 consecutive incarnations in the same gender. To say that 7 consecutive incarnations in the same gender are the rule contradicts all esoteric experience. Before we begin to study the karma of the individual human being, one fundamental fact must be borne in mind. There is a common karma, a karma that is not determined by the single individual, although it is adjusted in the course of that individual's incarnations. Here is a concrete example. When the Huns poured over from Asia into the countries of Europe during the early Middle Ages, causing alarming wars, there was a significant spiritual aspect to this. The Huns were the last surviving remnant of ancient Atlantean peoples. They were in an advanced stage of decadence, which expressed itself in a certain process of decay in their astral and ether bodies. These products of decay found good soil in the fear and terror the Huns caused among the peoples. The result was that these products of decay were inoculated into the astral bodies of the peoples, and in a later generation this was carried over into their physical bodies. The skin absorbed the astral elements, and the outcome was a disease prevalent in the Middle Ages, leprosy. An ordinary doctor would, of course, attribute leprosy to physical causes. I have no wish to dispute what such doctors say, but their line of reasoning is as follows. In a fight, someone wounds another with a knife. He has harbored an old feeling of revenge against him. One person will say that the cause of the wound was the feeling of revenge, another that the knife was the cause. Both are right. The knife was the final physical cause, but behind it there is the spiritual cause. Those who seek for spiritual causes will always also admit the validity of physical causes. We see that historical events have a significant effect upon whole generations, and we learn how even in such fundamental conditions as health, we can bring about improvements over long periods of time. As a result of technical progress in recent centuries, an industrial proletariat has developed among the peoples of Europe, and together with it, untold rank and class hatred. This has its seat in the astral body, and comes to physical expression as pulmonary tuberculosis. Such knowledge is revealed by spiritual research. It is often not within our power to help those who are afflicted by general karma of this kind. We are often compelled, with aching hearts, to see an individual suffering without being able to make him well or happy because he is caught in the network of general karma. Only by working for the improvement of the common karma can we also help the individual. It should not be our aim to promote the well-being of the single egotistic self, but to work in such a way that we serve the well-being of humanity as a whole. Another example directly connected with current events is the following. Spiritual observations have revealed that among the astral beings who participated in the various battles of the Russo-Japanese War, there were dead Russians working against their own people. This was due to the fact that during recent times in the development of the Russian people, many noble idealists perished in the dungeon or on the scaffold. They were men of high ideals, but they were not so far developed as to be able to forgive. They died with feelings of bitter revenge against those who had been the cause of their death. These feelings of revenge were lived out in their Kamaloka period, for only in Kamaloka is this possible. From the astral plane, after their death, they filled the souls of the Japanese soldiers with hatred and revenge against the people to whom they themselves had belonged. Had they already been in Devakan, they would have said, "I forgive my enemies," for in Devakan, with the clouds of hatred and revenge confronting them from without, they would have realized how terrible and how unworthy such feelings are. Thus, spiritual investigation reveals that whole peoples fall under the influence of their forefathers. The idealistic endeavors of modern times cannot attain their goals because people are willing to work only with physical means on the physical plane. This applies, for example, to the Society for the Promotion of Peace, which sets out to bring about peace by physical methods alone. Not until we learn how to influence the astral plane, too, can we recognize the right methods. Not until then can we work in such a way that when the human being is born again, he will find a world in which he can labor fruitfully. The end of Lecture 5.